Coming up on The Green from Delaware Public Media, we conclude our two-part look at the education funding lawsuit before the Court of Chancery by examining the state's system for delivering school funds.
By the time it's over, I believe the judge is going to tell the state that it has to do more. I'm not sure how much more, and that whatever it takes, whatever it's going to do, is going to have to be sustainable and permanent.
Contributor Larry Nangas joins us with the issues raised by the suit and the possible paths forward. I'm your host, Tom Byrne. We'll also learn about some promising kinesiology research at Delaware State University and delve into our archives for a piece connected to this year's Oscar winner for Best Picture. Plus, more great student work produced at WMPH and Mount Pleasant High School with help from our Generation Voice Youth Media Program. It's all next on The Green, where Delaware explores its common ground. But first, the news from NPR. Welcome to this week's edition of The Green on Delaware Public Media. I'm your host, Tom Byrne. Last week, we began a two-part look at the lawsuit filed last year by Delawareans for Educational Opportunity and the NAACP Delaware State Conference of Branches. The suit is challenging Delaware's system of funding public education in the Court of Chancery, contending that inequities in the funding system impair the opportunity of disadvantaged students to receive an adequate education. The plaintiffs also argue the current system for levying property taxes at the county level contributes to the problem because it violates long-established standards set by the Delaware General Assembly. In Part 1 last week, contributor Larry Nangas examined the thorny issue of assessments and property taxes. This week, he delves into another piece of the suit, the actual system used by the state to deliver education funding. The piece is online right now at DelawarePublic.org, and Larry sat down with me earlier this week to discuss it.
So the argument the plaintiffs are making seems to boil down to this. Not enough money is reaching students that need it most. Low-income students, English language learners, students with disabilities. And your piece suggests that the state's own numbers show that these groups do need more support. How stark are those numbers?
Well, it's pretty bleak. In the first pages of the opinion that he issued in late November, Vice Chancellor Travis Laster itemizes the performance of low-income English language learners and special education students on the state's Smarter Balanced Assessment Test for the 2015-16 and 2016-17 school years. For the 2015-16 school year, the best performance of any of these subgroups was 35.6% of the low-income students gaining a proficient rating in language arts. That's just over one-third of the students in that grouping. English language learners and special ed students were less successful in language arts, and the proficiency levels in math were even lower for all three of these groups. And this pattern repeated itself in 2016-17. In some areas, proficiency levels fell to being as low as 10%. Now, what this shows, through the testing system that the state chose and through the scoring system that the state created, is that a very large proportion of the children are not developing the skills that they need to function as productive adults in our society. Low-income students represent 37% of the public school population, special ed students 15%, and English language learners 7%. Now, even when you allow for the overlap of students who fit into two of these groups, or perhaps all three, we're talking about close to one-half of the public school population.
And we've already seen that the judge in this case, as you mentioned, Vice Chancellor Laster, he seems to find these numbers pretty compelling based on what he wrote about them in that opinion you cited, rejecting the state's request that the suit be dismissed. What did he say, kind of putting these numbers in context, at least from his perspective?
Well, in filing the suit, the plaintiff's attorneys assembled a lot of data on how state funds were allocated, and they also summarized initiatives that have helped disadvantaged students in other states to do better academically. Laster looked at all of this information, and he described the state's funding system in one word: counterintuitive. Now, why did he say that? Well, because he found, and let me give you the quote, "The educational funding system generally provides more support for more privileged children than it provides for impoverished children. Schools with more disadvantaged students receive less financial support from the state than schools with fewer disadvantaged students."
So what was the state's argument to dismiss, given their own proficiency numbers that we've cited, and how did Laster respond to what the state was trying to say was the reason why this wasn't a problem.
You know, when we talked last week, I described how the county defendants on the property assessment side of this case couldn't refute the facts, so they relied on some technicalities to try to get off the hook, and the judge didn't buy it. On the funding side of the case, the state has tried a similar tactic. The state claimed that all the state constitution requires is that the school system be, quote, general and efficient. That it really doesn't matter whether the students who passed through that system were learning anything. Well, the judge didn't buy that claim either. And he created what he described as a nightmare scenario, something that could possibly occur if that was what the state really, really believed. So here's what he wrote. The state could corral disadvantaged students into warehouses, hand out one book for every 50 students, assign some adults to maintain discipline, and tell the students to take turns reading to themselves. Okay, you know, that's obviously an extreme example, an extreme scenario that the vice chancellor put into his own words. But you know, if you carry the state's position, you know, to an extreme extension, that's conceivably what you could have. I mean, they're not saying that the school system really has to do anything, measurable to educate students.
So, with that in mind, what do the plaintiffs want to see happen to make sure that the money gets where it needs to go and help the students that need that help the most?
Okay. Well, you know, generally there are two pieces to the solution. First, the plaintiffs say that there's a need for more and better services. This means, among other things, hiring more teachers to create smaller class sizes, adding reading specialists and math coaches, starting after-school programs, expanding counseling services, and doing more to address the trauma and stress these students face outside the classroom. The second piece is how you're going to pay for it. And this is where political will has been lacking for years. It's going to require more money, and the middle and upper middle class adults whose children go to the schools that are now getting more money are not going to be happy if they see their school budgets cut. And I suspect that some of them will resent paying more taxes if additional money is going to be spent on schools that their own children don't attend. Now, the state is saying that they don't want the courts to come up with the solution. They want the legislature to do it. This issue has been talked about for years, but the legislature hasn't done anything yet. Will it be different this time? Well, we're just going to have to see.
And we are seeing some efforts from the state and the Carney administration to address these funding inequities, specifically what seems to be the first real stab at something approaching weighted funding, and that is Governor Carney's three-year $60 million plan that we've reported on previously to target English language learners and low-income students. For those unfamiliar, can you give us kind of a thumbnail sketch of what that plan is and what it's trying to accomplish?
Okay, well, it's $20 million a year for 3 years, and it would go to all of the schools in the state, and the money would be allocated with $300 extra going to each low-income students, $500 extra for each English language learner. Now, schools would have pretty broad discretion in creating plans for spending the money. There's no one-size-fits-all plan here, Colonial School District Superintendent Dusty Blakey tells me. You know, as one example, you know, districts that have low-income or English language learner students concentrated in one or two schools might start by doing intensive programs in those schools. If these disadvantaged students with special needs are spread more evenly throughout the district, you know, perhaps they take a different approach, maybe do something like with teacher training, so that all of the teachers in the district would be exposed to, you know, better theories, better approaches to working with all these students. So, you know, the situation, how the money might be allocated, how the programs might be developed, is going to depend upon the situation within the district. Regardless of what type of program gets created, ultimately they're all going to be evaluated in 3 years by the State Department of Education. The ones that would seem to be working the best are likely, again, depending on the availability of funds down the road, but the ones that seem to be working best would be candidates to be replicated in other school districts.
So what's the reaction been to this plan? Is it seen as enough?
Yeah, generally the reaction has been positive. The legislators that I've talked to think that the plan will make it all the way through the state budget process. And, you know, there are a couple of issues here, and I think it's fair to say, you know, people looking at this thing, this is a first step. It's not the final answer. First, there's this concern with the Department of Education and how they're going to evaluate these pilot programs. You know, DOE can't use a system that relies heavily on standardized test scores. I mean, because we know what the standardized test scores have shown is that if you've got a lot of low-income and English language learner students in your schools, your school is going to perform poorly. And if you have smaller percentages of these, your scores are going to be better. So the test scores themselves are not a really good indicator here. The measurement has to, and you've got to consider that's because these so many students are starting below grade level. So the measurement can't be whether students are working at grade level, but rather it has to be the growth that they're showing. And they can measure this. So the idea is, how well are these students doing at being able to catch up to their peers? Are they closing the gap individually? Now, the second concern is that the governor's proposal covers only 3 years. Both educators and lawmakers know that they need a plan that will be sustainable and that it'll be permanent. And this gets us back to the funding issue that I was talking about a minute ago. Once again, we're going to have to see what happens.
Well, with that in mind, and the idea that this is a first step as opposed to maybe a final solution, which you mentioned, are there other plans out there that could work kind of concurrently with this or address other pieces of this as an issue?
Nobody is ready to talk about anything comprehensive and long-term. Well, I mean, they're talking about it, but there's nothing on paper that looks like a model or, you know, a long-range blueprint. But there are things that are addressing pieces of the puzzle. A couple of legislators are talking about the real estate property assessment issue. They realize that they may have to act to require the counties to conduct new property assessments, but nobody has any details on that yet. Now, Representative Earl Jakes, who's chairman of the House Education Committee, he tells me that he is working on legislation that would give school boards limited authority to raise property taxes from year to year. This would largely replace our current referendum system, which we discussed last week, which costs a lot of time and money and often builds resentment among taxpayers, who often see referendums as, you know, the one chance that they have to say no to government at any level. Now, as Representative Jake sees it, when districts hold a referendum, what they do is they ask for a large pot of money to cover spending increases that they expect to incur over 4, 5, 6 years. And so then they start collecting this money, and a lot of it at the start anyway gets put in the school district's bank account. And so it's in the school district's pocket, rather than the taxpayer's pocket. And then the school districts gradually spend that money down. Now, Jakes thinks that property owners would rather see smaller tax increases, even if they came every year, and that way they would be able to hang on to their own money for a longer period of time. Now, also in the works, Representative Kim Williams is back with legislation that she's been pushing for the last 3 or 4 years, and that would provide more funds for special education students in kindergarten through third grade. And that's another group that, you know, whose issues are mentioned fairly significantly in the lawsuit.
Is it fair to say that this all may boil down to whether or not Vice Chancellor Laster finds these efforts you're talking about compelling and believes the state and lawmakers will actually follow through with them in the absence of a court order compelling them to do so? Is this a case where the plaintiffs are arguing, we've heard this all before, but where has it actually gotten us?
Yeah, you're right on both counts. From reading Laster's two rulings in this suit, it's pretty clear that the state is not going to get off the hook easily, or the counties for that matter. Face it, the state is kind of stuck. It's their own assessment system that's showing that the schools aren't serving disadvantaged children well. And the finance reforms that the plaintiffs are looking for are the same things that have been debated by educators and lawmakers in Delaware off and on for about 10 years, maybe longer. So by the time it's over, I believe the judge is going to tell the state that it has to do more. I'm not sure how much more, and that whatever it takes, whatever it's going to do, is going to have to be sustainable and permanent. It's not going to allow for any short-term fixes. As for the plaintiffs, I'm certain they will be asking that the judge retain some sort of jurisdiction over the case so that they will have the opportunity to go back in the court if they feel that the state isn't meeting whatever obligations are set out in the final ruling.
And finally, even though this case is not likely to be decided until next year, One thing that does appear clear is that it has created a greater sense of urgency. Is that a fair read of the situation?
Yes, most definitely. I would agree. I was reporting back in the 70s during the desegregation case. And back then, you know, if you asked a suburban or a downstate legislator what they would do, they'd say they'd fight that case all the way up to the U.S. Supreme Court. And if you asked them about a desegregation plan, well, you know, the best they could come up with would be some sort of a voluntary one. Now, today, when you talk to legislators, you'll get a much more measured response. They know that properties haven't been reassessed in some 40 years. They know that educators have been asking for more money for these programs for years, and they haven't delivered. They know that state education officials have been asking for and receiving federal grants to address these very same needs. Now, finding long-term solutions will not be easy, and I suspect that there are some legislators who are hoping they'll be able to tell their constituents that it's some judge's fault that the taxes are going up. You know, but the bottom line here is this. The legislators know that this case may well be wrapped up next year and that some change in the school funding system is almost inevitable. So this time around, Tom, I'm going to end it with a couple of questions. Who's going to make the changes? Will it be the General Assembly? Will Governor Carney lead the way? Or will it take another court order?
Thanks to contributor Larry Nightingale for his time on The Green this week. This piece on the state's education funding system and last week's piece on assessments and property taxes are available right now at DelawarePublic.org. And The Green continues in just a moment with a look at research being done at Delaware State University that could identify athletes and others at high risk for ankle injuries. You're listening to The Green on Delaware Public Media. The Green on Delaware Public Media, and I'm Tom Byrne. Two Delaware State University researchers have discovered a way of determining whether a person possesses a high risk for ankle injuries. The research began 3 years ago with Dr. Von Homer, who was working at Barry University in Miami at the time. Dr. Homer was looking to better understand how balance in the human body is controlled. He continued his research when he came to DSU to pursue a PhD and approached the university's kinesiology lab about looking more closely at what balance looks like from a neurological perspective. Dr. Homer partnered with Dr. Chris Mason, the chair of DSU's Department of Public and Allied Health Sciences, to find the answers. Delaware Public Media's Kelly Steele spoke with Dr. Mason about this research, which revealed that the amount of work encumbered by the ankle muscles to maintain equilibrium can give a strong indication of whether a high risk of ankle injury exists, and how adding orthotics can help with this issue.
Well, what we originally were setting out to do was to actually better characterize human balance and postural control. And so we were focusing on looking at the neuromuscular control of specifically the ankle joint, which is a joint that is very influential in maintaining someone's overall balance. And so what we wanted to do was essentially look at how the ankle was controlled by the nervous system and the muscular system around the ankle, in terms of helping people to maintain balance. And what we started to find were that individuals had different strategies that they used at the ankle to maintain their balance, which involved different levels of muscle activation around the ankle. And so when we found that the individual strategy would change from person to person, athlete to athlete, or just, you know, regular, everyday human to human, we figured that this might mean something. And it might mean that certain individuals are at a higher risk for injury. And so actually, Kelly, the scope of the research changed quite a bit once we made that observation. And so what happened was there was a company by the name of Matt Market. And Matt Market, they manufacture shoe and footwear textiles. And one product that they were manufacturing at the time, so this has been going on over the last 3 years, the development of the research. They were developing a foot orthotic or a shoe orthotic, like a Dr. Scholl's shoe insert. And they heard what we were doing in our labs, and they approached us, and they wanted to partner with us in order to collect data that would validate their product. So they wanted research and data performed on this shoe orthotic to see how it influenced human movement, and specifically how it influenced human balance and postural control. And so we agreed to do that, and we started to do some research with our own athletes at DSU, from various teams. So we tested the football team, men's and women's basketball team, actually the bowling team, women's lacrosse team, and some soccer players as well, before and after they started using these orthotics. And what we found was that their balance started to improve. And also, the way that they controlled their ankle started to improve, which ultimately made them safer in terms of their level of injury risk. And so once we found that, that these orthotics were actually beneficial for athletic performance, and even more meaningful, that we were able to start to see some reduction in injury risk with these orthotics, the research continued to grow from there. So we started to actually gain some traction with some pretty large institutions and organizations. So we started to get some attention from the NFL, from other NCAA institutions, and also some other shoe companies who are interested in how their shoes affect human movement and affect the risk of lower extremity injury. So it's all happened over maybe 2 or 3 years, and recently, over the course of the last few months, it really has started to get some attention, like I said, and gain some traction and really take off. So it's an exciting time for us in our exercise and rehab lab and also our biomechanics lab at DSU.
Okay, so I have a bunch of questions. So
sure.
First, the resulting innovation, it's been trademarked as the Homer technique.
Correct.
How did that name come about?
So my colleague, his name is Von Homer. He's a faculty member at Delaware State in our department. This project actually started as his PhD dissertation project. So the scope of the research that I mentioned, just simply trying to characterize balance, was what he was interested in doing his dissertation work on. So about 3 summers ago, the department was going through some transition, and we revamped our curriculum. We actually changed the name of the major from movement science to kinesiology, and we started this pretty big research initiative where we were trying to infuse and emphasize undergraduate research and the importance of it, and also start to conduct more of it through our labs. And so I was charged with leading that initiative as our research coordinator, and I recently started doing some small projects in our labs. And over that summer, I was approached by Dr. Von Homer, who also has a second degree. He's earning his second PhD currently in neuroscience, and he also has a terminal degree in podiatry. And so he was interested basically in coming to DSU to get a PhD in neuroscience so he could better understand his first doctoral degree in podiatry. So I thought that was interesting, and he wanted to look at kind of the neuroscience behind human movement, which is what my background is in. And so it was sort of a perfect partnership when I was approached with his idea for his research. So over time, like I said, we worked in the lab, kind of toiled away, and figured out our data collection protocol. And then once it was validated and once it started to get some attention, and once we realized that we were actually predicting risk level of injury, we trademarked the name. And since it's his dissertation, his project, what better name for it than the Homer technique? And so that's how the name of the test or the protocol came about.
All right, answer this in layman's terms. How and why, I guess more why, did the kinesiology research even come about? Did somebody hurt their ankle and you two scientists got together and said, we're going to do this research?
So it is human balance and postural control is a widely studied area of kinesiology. It's pretty widely known that poor balance equals poor sports performance and a higher risk of injury, just having bad balance alone. It's been well studied. And so there are tests out there that have quantified balance previously and continue to do so. And those tests have been used to say that someone, due to their poor balance, has a higher risk of injury. And so we wanted to take it a step further and kind of answer the why questions of that. Why does poor balance sometimes result in poor performance and a higher risk of injury? And to answer those questions, we decided to investigate the nervous system's contribution to that and to see if it's more of a nervous system activation issue or more of a muscle weakness issue, which it has commonly been attributed to through the years. So we were just simply interested, Kelly, in trying to find another answer or a deeper answer into why poor balance equals poor sports performance and also higher risk of injury.
So, Dr. Mason, is the end goal, if there is an end goal, is the end goal to get athletes all across the country at all colleges and universities to use these orthotics?
Ultimately, that would be the end goal, would be to make athletes all over the world and all over the country aware of the benefits of products such as orthotics, and then also give them some information about exactly how it's affecting their bodies and affecting their movement. Also, by using the Homer technique, we can, like I said, quantify someone's neuromuscular control and how hard and how efficient muscles around the ankle are working. So hopefully we can offer what we learned through our research as a service to teams, to specific athletes all over the world so that they can better analyze and characterize their performance levels of their athletes. And then in turn, it could also lead to better rehabilitation techniques that are used instead of just making things stronger. We hopefully are going to be able to pinpoint which nerves, which muscle fibers are being activated the most or which ones are being used inefficiently in athletes and train the body related to neuromuscular control and not necessarily strength and conditioning.
You know, we've talked a lot about ankles and how these orthotics can be used. Are the orthotics good for other things? I know people wear orthotics to help with plantar fasciitis, to help with things like that. Can you address that?
So they are good for issues such as plantar fasciitis because in addition to changing how the ankle is controlled, it also changes the alignment of the body in general. So it changes pressure points on the foot, which will change someone's gait, which will change their overall alignment and postural control. And so while it is also helping, you know, specifically balance and postural control, it's going to help other ailments that are due to misalignment of the body and inefficient mechanics.
Thanks to Dr. Chris Mason, chair of DSU's Department of Public and Allied Health Sciences, and our Kelly Steele for their time on The Green this week. Next, we dig into The Green's vault to bring you a piece that we aired 2 years ago that's connected to this year's Oscar winner for Best Picture. Stay with us. This is Delaware Public Media. Welcome back to The Green on Delaware Public Media. I'm your host, Tom Byrne. Last Sunday, the Oscar for Best Picture went to Green Book. The film is based on a true story about a working-class Italian-American man who gets a job as a chauffeur and bodyguard for a gay African-American musician and drives him through the segregated South of the early 1960s. But the movie doesn't delve much into what the Green Book it's named after was really all about. 2 years ago, former Delaware Public Media reporter Megan Pauly did. She brought us the story of this safe haven guide created specifically for African-American travelers called the Negro Motorist Green Book from a first state perspective.
The year was 1954, and Don Blakey was headed from Washington, D.C. to Dover to attend Delaware State University, then known as Delaware State College. Blakey doesn't remember feeling the impact of segregated life in D.C., but says that changed once he reached Delaware.
You felt it when you got off the train in Dover.
He arrived before Labor Day weekend that year, and school didn't start until after the holiday. So to pass the time and make some money, he and some buddies drove down to Rehoboth Beach, where they worked as busboys in the white-only hotels and restaurants. That's where Blakey heard about Rosedale Beach, a resort and hotel owned and operated by African-Americans for African-Americans. After a long day at work, he'd head over to Rosedale where he could relax and listen to some jazz from some of the great musicians of that time, like Louis Armstrong, Ray Charles, and Ella Fitzgerald, all night and into the wee hours of the morning before resuming another day of work.
Can you imagine Duke Ellington's orchestra leaving Philadelphia and traveling all the way to Rosedale? Well, Rosedale was not the primary place. It was Rehoboth where they actually played for their funds, but they're going to have to leave there. and try and find their way back home on these dark Delaware roads with no signs, no lights, and police all over the place. So someone said, why don't you go over to Rosedale? They can put you up. Welcome. Can you play for us? And they said, yeah, we'll do a whole set for you. Well, they played for the opportunity to have food and a place to sleep. Now, that becomes a drawing, a magnet for customers. Duke Ellington's going to be here this weekend. Count Basie, and everybody's flocking to this place.
And when Duke Ellington and others played that second set at Rosedale, Blakey said boats full of white people would pull up near the beach shore to listen to the music as it drifted out to sea. Not only was Rosedale on the Chitlin Circuit, a national circuit of performance venues that were safe and acceptable for African American musicians, comedians, and other entertainers, it was also listed as a vacation spot in the Negro Motorist Green Book.
Because it was a safe area, and that's what they were. The Green Book was outlining safe areas for African Americans to drop in on, to stay, get comfort, get information, feel good, and then move on to the next.
But entertainment venues like Rosedale and the Rodney Hotel weren't the only Delaware safe havens listed in the guide.
Gas stations, restaurants, barbershops, beauty salons.
That's Carlton Hall with Delaware's Division of Cultural Affairs, listing off examples of some establishments included in the Green Book. Hall began researching Green Book stops in Delaware in 2014, such as Randolph's Nest Restaurant, operated by Joseph Randolph and his wife for over 30 years in southern Delaware.
Two doors down from Randolph's Nest, which was the restaurant, he had a tourist home, which he named Randolph's Rest, with an R.
Tourist homes were like the bed and breakfasts or Airbnbs of today. Most tourist home listings in the Green Book had live-in hosts. Hall says it's likely there were many additional tourist homes that existed in Delaware, but that weren't listed in the Green Book, but instead utilized via word of mouth.
And when I talk about the Green Book, a lot of people think that they're all of the listings in the area, but they're not. They are only the listings that the owners decide that they want to advertise in the Green Book. So the Green Book's not a definitive list, just those who chose to advertise.
Today, Hall gives presentations about the book across Delaware. He describes the book as being about the same size as a Jet magazine.
And you would have listings, and you'd have a vacation section, and you'd have a little bit about the owner of the guy, Victor Green, who started the Green Book in there.
Calvin Ramsey, a New York writer and playwright, began looking into Victor Green's legacy after he came to know about the Green Book at a funeral in Atlanta in 2001.
The grandfather came down for the funeral, and the grandfather was African-American, his first time in the Deep South, and he thought he still needed a Green Book. After the service, he mentioned that he was looking for a Green Book, and I said, well, what's that? And he started telling me all about it.
Ramsey says Green realized there was a need for such a travel guide while making trips every year to visit his wife's family in Richmond, Virginia.
I think that's how he knew how hard it was on the open road for blacks to travel. And from that experience with her, a Jewish friend gave him the idea that maybe he should start a travel book of his own, for the Jewish community had their own travel guide as well.
Green launched the book in 1936 in the New York metro area, eventually expanding its reach to 46 states. During that time, he kept his day job as a union postal worker, using his connections in the National Association of Postal and Federal Employees to expand the booklet's listings.
Just like today, the mail carriers know more about our neighborhoods than anyone else, and they would screen people in there on their routes, who to ask, who they thought may have an extra room or a house that could accommodate people traveling. So it just grew from there. There was no phone numbers in the Green Book. It was just addresses.
Eventually, Green's business got so big he had to move it out of his home and into an office space. He also utilized the emerging Esso gas stations network to help advertise Green Books. In New York alone, Esso employed at least two African-American representatives whose sole responsibility was to advertise the books. Blakey says he thinks that's how his football team's bus drivers discovered safe spots for the team to frequent while on long journeys to and from away games.
When we left in the morning, like at 4 o'clock in the morning, and we were going to Charlotte, North Carolina, which we could have made in one day, we stopped 4 hours after we had begun in Richmond. And at that time, I didn't understand it. I would say, oh, maybe we're just stopping for a break. But it was a safe haven stop to stop in Richmond, downtown Richmond, at the same restaurant for the whole 4 years, where we could eat, we could discuss our plans for the game, we could talk about education and other things, and it was safe.
Blakey met his wife, Dolores, at Delaware State. She was a cheerleader who helped make sandwiches and snacks for those long trips and welcomed the team home.
It was great. Under those circumstances, it was still, that was great. It does not happen today because the people on campus, the young people on campus, don't even know the team is gone. Or when they return, they only know that they played a game. It was a different situation altogether.
Gone, too, is the need for temporary beds Blakey would make up for visiting teams in attics and abandoned buildings. Rosedale Beach has also disappeared. Blakey says it was severely damaged by a hurricane in the early 1960s, and with segregation illegal at that point, they didn't rebuild.
I can go anywhere, so why would I want to go here? I'll go to Rehoboth. I'll go to Lewis. I'll go to this place. So now I can't rebuild because I don't have the customer base to provide the money to rebuild. So they close.
Don and Dolores are trying to keep the history of Rosedale and its connection to the Green Book alive. They perform historical reenactments across the first state.
People come up to us all the time saying, yeah, I remember that. I remember so-and-so and such-and-such. So we did strike a chord. And it was just by chance that I was there, remembered it, and then later on in life we began to do these kinds of things and said, let's reflect on Rosedale.
The Green Book continued after Victor Green's death in 1960, lasting until 1967 thanks to his wife and an all-female staff. Hall says the language on the book's covers in the last few years of its existence reflected the still hostile environment that continued after Brown versus Board of Education.
You still have for vacation without aggravation. And 1964 is, you know, right around the Civil Rights Act. And, you know, basically at that point, you know, segregation is not really the law anymore, but it wasn't really enforced. So we still kind of had difficulties.
And Ramsey says Victor Green envisioned a time when the Green Book would become obsolete.
He felt like one day the laws would change and blacks would have open accommodations on the open road and the Green Book would no longer be needed. And he was looking forward to that day because he didn't know that blacks would be treated as full-fledged citizens like everyone else. So he was doing the Green Book as a necessity. He didn't want to do it forever. He was just doing that to help.
The Green Book's legacy is being preserved with many copies digitally cataloged and available for viewing online through the New York Public Library. And you'll find many Delaware tourist homes listed in the Green Book are still there at the address listed. For Delaware Public Media, I'm Megan Pauley.
Thanks to former Delaware Public Media reporter Megan Pauley for this piece on the Green Book, which originally aired in June 2017. Next up on the Green, Enlighten Me, which highlights more student work from WMPH at Mount Pleasant High School in the Brandywine School District, part of our Generation Voice Youth Media Project. You're listening to The Green on Delaware Public Media. Thanks for spending time with us on The Green this week. I'm Tom Byrne. For a second straight week, Enlighten Me takes us to WMPH and Mount Pleasant High School in the Brandywine School District, one of the two schools we've partnered with on our Generation Voice Youth Media Project. Students there and at our other partner, WMHS, at McCain High School in the Red Clay School District, produce interviews and features throughout the year. And from time to time, we'd like to highlight some of that work right here on the Green. And again, this week, we have two features produced at Mount Pleasant's WMPH. The first is from junior Will Roosh. He notes that even though the latest unemployment statistics put the Delaware jobless rate at 3.7% and the national rate at 4%, many teenagers still struggle to find jobs. And he attempted to find out why.
Imagine you just turned 16. Your parents are asking you to get a job to pay for the gear and shoes you want. Only one problem. It is hard to find a job when you are still in school and have no consistent way to get to work.
I feel like there's not as many resources available to teens as they said there would be. Because I went into this thinking, all right, it's going to be super easy to find a job. They're going to have a website or something. There's nothing. I can't find anything. I went to one website, and now I get spam calls 4 times a day from random numbers saying, we have employment opportunities, but then they hang up when I say I'm in high school.
That's Sean. He says he has applied to 11 jobs in the past year and has not gotten any of them. The overall unemployment rate in U.S. is down. According to the Bureau of Labor Statistics, unemployment has dropped by about 0.5% since 2016. If that's the case, why is it so hard for teens to find jobs? George Sharpley is in charge of statistics for the Delaware Department of Labor.
Well, there's a variety of issues there. I mean, one would be skills, right?
Yeah.
I mean, you haven't had time to build up the skills that employers are really demanding.
According to the Employment Policies Institute, unemployment for teens 16 to 19 years old is about 26%, and many teens have difficulty finding that first job. Wes Davis is director of development for West End Neighborhood House.
Although now unemployment is at historic lows for adults, teen unemployment, especially for youth ages 16 to 24, has typically been much higher, nearly 3 times as much according to the U.S. Bureau of Labor Statistics for 2015, which has not changed much in terms of the trend.
Transportation is one barrier to teen employment. Without a consistent ride to work, many teens won't be able to get or keep a job. And I can tell you from experience, the public transportation is not an option. It doesn't go to my workplace when I need to get there. Sharpley agrees it's an issue.
I mean, obviously, if you have reliable transportation, then the area that you can go get a job in expands.
Even teens who do have jobs may struggle to earn enough money. Companies that hire teens often pay the minimum wage, which of January 1st became $8.75 for most people in Delaware. However, rather than raise the minimum wage for everyone to $8.75, Delaware created its first youth wage for anyone younger than 18 and its first training wage for new hires in their first 90 days, both of which pay 50 cents less than a new standard minimum wage. All this to delay paying teens like me that extra 50 cents, which would have meant an extra $20 in my paycheck. But the good news is, by the end of 2019, most clerks and fast food workers will be collecting $9.25 an hour. Wes Davis again.
The situation has changed a bit, but I think the trend still continues in that there aren't as many entry level jobs, summer jobs that there used to be for teens specifically.
Another big issue is school and extracurricular activities. Many teens are still in school for most of the day, which means they can only work afternoons, nights, and weekends. Then there are the teens who play sports and participate in many after-school activities. This makes it very hard to schedule teens for consistent or significant hours. George Sharpley again.
I think for, trying to get a job that fits your schedule as a full-time student can be tricky, because that's your main job is studying. So to get a job that you can kind of fit around that and the hours work for you, that's not always the easiest thing to do.
So even though unemployment as a whole is at a low, some of us are still waiting for those numbers to start to show in teen unemployment.
Thanks to Junior Will Roosh for his piece. Next, we hear from Senior Amaya Williams. Gun violence has been a persistent problem in Wilmington, and as police departments and lawmakers work to change that, Amaya explores the psychological impact of violence can have on teens growing up in Delaware's largest city.
In 2017, Wilmington, Delaware was considered the deadliest city in the United States for juveniles. A USA Today, an AP analysis of several years of juvenile shootings data, showed Wilmington had a higher rate than Chicago. According to Wilmington Police Department data, there were 19 juvenile shooting victims in the city in 2017 and 8 last year.
There are children all throughout our state who are living in war zones in their own home.
That's then City Councilwoman Sherry Dorsey Walker talking to WMPH in 2016. She said witnessing violence can impact adolescents' behavior. Wilmington child psychotherapist Palai Payne says it can affect a child's ability to communicate.
Sometimes you see that they're not able to verbalize themselves when they do get upset. So instead of being able to say, I'm frustrated right now, because maybe they've seen people, use guns, or they've seen people hit when they get upset. They'll hit or they'll say, I'll shoot.
Violence is more common in some areas than in others. According to the state's Criminal Justice Council, in 2016, more than half of the shooting incidents in the state came from the city of Wilmington. Some begin to grow accustomed to it. However, that doesn't make the blow any softer. Palai shared how a shooting outside of a school she worked at altered the students' behavior.
But I would say it wasn't abnormal in that neighborhood to have a shooting around the school. And we've had that. It does affect their ability to learn.
Dorsey Walker argues that it could have happened before the child even reached school grounds.
This is what my babies are seeing. These, my same babies, are seeing this in their community, and then they have to go to school the next day.
It's widely agreed that gun violence in Wilmington is a problem, but setting policy around guns is where people tend to disagree. Delaware gun rights advocate Mitch Denham does not think that eliminating access to guns is the answer. He thinks many who are against guns are simply scared by what they see on TV and in movies. He thinks firearms are
supposed to prevent oppression by the government. And that was the original intent of the Founding Fathers when they wrote the Second Amendment, was to provide the people with the ability to protect themselves in the event that they were ever forced into a situation of tyranny again.
But Denham does support restrictions on who can buy guns.
I don't think that there's any way you could possibly ever do enough in that situation. I think that there's always going to be someone that falls through. I think that we are doing a lot better job than we were doing. The red flag bill, the Beau Biden Gun Act of last year that Delaware proposed and passed, will do a lot to help with that.
These bills are two of several pieces of state-level gun safety reform legislation that were signed into law last year. Both of these laws have the same goal: to keep firearms out of the hands of potentially dangerous individuals. According to state officials, the Beau Biden Gun Violence Prevention Act allows mental health professionals who consider an individual a danger to themselves or others to alert law enforcement officials. An officer can then seek a court order for their firearms to be relinquished. To ensure that this is done justly, probable cause is required and the order can be appealed. The red flag law allows family members to start a similar process. According to state officials, other gun safety legislation passed last year toughened penalties for straw purchases and banned bump stocks in the state. A proposed ban on assault weapons that failed to pass the General Assembly last year may be reintroduced this year, according to the News Journal. Sherry Dorsey Walker was elected to the State House of Representatives last fall. While talking to WMPH in 2016, she worried that few lawmakers had direct experience with gun violence.
If you have never lived it and you don't understand it and you're making laws about them, then maybe you just need to step outside of your comfort zone and get to know what other people endure on a regular basis. This is everyday life for some of our children.
Dorsey Walker maintains that laws and legislation aren't always the best answer.
What our children are in need of is mental health counseling. They don't need to be penalized criminally for, in some cases, juvenile behavior.
Payne agrees, adding that access to treatment often depends on economic factors.
So it really depends on what neighborhood you're from, what resources they have, right? So ideally, there would be therapists, there would be school professionals, there would be, you know, psychiatric hospitals, all these things that are helping. And sometimes kids do have those resources and sometimes they don't.
Amir Carter grew up on Wilmington's west side, specifically down bottom, a term Wilmingtonians use to describe the area surrounding the Riverside Projects. It's an area residents know is notorious for juvenile shootings. He vividly remembers seeing and hearing about shootings, even witnessing one in person.
They just came out of nowhere and started shooting. And mind you, it's little kids at the park. It's like young teens, like I can say like 13, 14. It was the highest age I was there. And everybody was like jumping under cars and running down the street. First, they thought it was firecrackers and they saw the gun. It was a mess.
He thinks witnessing incidents similar to this have affected how he feels about his community. Carter says staying aware of your surroundings is the key to staying safe.
I mean, I feel okay, like, walking around in my community, but you just have to be cautious so you don't know what's going to happen. Like, anything can pop off. Anything can get real hectic real quick.
Last year, Wilmington police reported a more than 50% drop in shootings in 2018 compared to the previous year. Carter has conflicting feelings about this. He says that even if it is decreasing, it's hard to recognize.
I don't know what's going on, to be honest. Like, there's always intervals. It's always, like, a couple months apart or, like, maybe a year apart or somebody gets shot at but not killed. Like, it might be going down, but nobody really notices it because they keep the negativity in the air.
Carter doesn't see any clear solutions. In Wilmington, I'm Amaya.
Thanks to Senior Amaya Williams for her piece. And a reminder that these stories are part of Generation Voice, our collaboration with the Brandywine School District at Mount Pleasant High School and its radio station WMPH. And the Red Clay School District at McCain High School and its radio station WMHS. Our youth media producer, Sophia Schmidt, oversees Generation Voice for us and worked on these pieces with teacher Paul Wishengrad, who runs the career pathway we work with at Mount Pleasant. And that's all we have time for on this week's edition of The Green. The stories and interviews you've heard are online right now at DelawarePublic.org. Just head to The Green's page on our website. And remember, you can also check out The Green via podcast at our website, on iTunes, and on the NPR One app. We'd also like to hear from you. Give us your feedback and story ideas on our Facebook page, on Twitter at TheGreenDE, or by emailing us at thegreen@delawarepublic.org. Thanks to all those who helped make today's show possible. Contributor Larry Nagengast, WMPH students Will Roosh and Amaya Williams, Delaware Public Media's Kelly Steele, and former Delaware Public Media reporter Megan Pauley. For all of them and the rest of the staff here at Delaware Public Media, I'm Tom Burns saying thanks for joining us, and we'll see you again next week on The Green, where Delaware explores its common ground.